Hello, I'm Costa Constanti, and welcome to Terra Nullius Cyprus. And I have a very special guest today on Terra Nullius. Let me introduce you all to Eleni Andoniou, a very good friend, and the reason why I've chosen her to be my second guest on Terra Nullius is because she was the first person to ever interview me in a podcast. So coming right off Magda, who was the OG of podcasting Women in Cyprus, I thought, who better to bring in than one of the biggest podcasters in the region, not just Cyprus, Eleni Andoniou. Welcome to the podcast.
Am I blushing? I am blushing a bit, aren't I?
Yeah, oh. If only we had videos.
after Magda, OG, definitely. It's an absolute honor to be on your podcast, and you've been on my podcast twice.
I have been. So, you know, I had to return the favor, but no, it wasn't just about returning the favor. It was, I listen to your podcast. I love what you do. I love what your guests have to say. And I thought, you know, it just makes total sense to have you on my podcast. Hopefully not just once. You know, we can keep repaying each other
I'm literally just around the corner. I walked here and I loved it, and I love this street as well. Yeah. And where we are now, so
well, it's probably worth mentioning, because I didn't mention it last time and that was my mistake, but we are at the CVR, the Center of Visual Arts and Research, on Edmund Street in Nicosia Old Town. I want to thank the Severities Foundation for hosting us and our co-sponsor Limoncello. Because we are actually now in the Glafkos Gliridis room, which is a room that has all of former President Gliridis' books, his gifts as president, his desk, his portrait. It's an amazing place to visit. So if you're ever in the area, as Eleni's just discovered today, it's quite a fascinating place to visit.
I walked in and my jaw was just on the floor. I'm like, where am I? Seriously. Gorgeous room.
No, yeah. It's definitely, and it's a good room that starts conversations. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man was such a huge political figure in Cyprus, and we'd like to believe that you and I are big political figures in Cyprus, right?
In our own way.
Well, we like to comment on politics.
In the modern social media era that we're living in.
So now, just before I started recording, we mentioned about podcast guests and what they're good for. Mm. And, you know, how do you interview somebody who's maybe shy or not able to eloquently deliver their message? Tell us a bit about one of your experiences of a podcast. Don't name names. Unless you want to be persons non grata to that person.
No.
But tell us a negative story. Tell us something that went wrong. You know, we hear the good things about you, but let's give us a behind the scenes blooper story.
Oh, okay. Let's see. To be honest with you, this month, actually, November, it will be 4 years since I started the podcast. So I started in 2019, and there are over 150 episodes, chats, discussions, some repeating guests, some brand new. Negative experience. The first thing that just comes off the top of my head was during lockdown. Mm-hmm. So I launched the podcast in November of 2019, and then the pandemic hit a few months later. I would do my podcast interviews in my car. Right. That's how I started. I didn't have equipment. I didn't have the knowledge. I didn't have the experience. I didn't have a studio, but I really, really wanted to do a podcast. So it started with me picking up my guests in my car after 6-7 o'clock in the evening, when my husband would come home, the kids would be settled so I could go off.
Just to interrupt.
Yeah,
you,
go on.
did this legitimately start as a podcast in a car, or did it? Yeah. Was this an excuse to go off for a drive and escape the family, and suddenly the podcast grew from that?
Oh man, do you know what? That would probably apply if I was one of those people who liked leaving my house. Mm-hmm. I'm not.
Okay.
Like if I get home at 3 o'clock with the kids after school, and it takes a lot to get me out again.
So.
So I just really, really wanted to do this. So I was willing to sacrifice
family time.
Not only for me time, man, not even family time. It was
have family time when the kids are at school.
yeah.
No, you had these guests in your car? Were you driving around or just parked somewhere?
No, we would park somewhere and I would record on my phone on voice notes.
So dodgy sounding.
Very. And I remember one time it was summer and I put the AC on and for some reason the phone switched off and I lost half of... the interview. That is actually one of the biggest fears I think we podcasters have. You know, you're always checking. You're like, oh, this is such a great conversation. Is it recording?
Yeah, is it a little red light?
You keep checking, yeah, because it's just there in the back of your head. So, I taught myself how to record on my phone. I bought a mobile interview kit, and then I taught myself how to edit on GarageBand. And then to produce and then to get it on the platform. And it started just me trying to do a podcast with three kids around me and just trying to get this information and these stories out. So in the pandemic, I couldn't do that. Obviously, there was no picking up of people in cars and whatever. So I learned how to record via the phone. Mm-hmm. And I did an interview with a lovely girl. She'd just become a mum. And we were talking about various eating habits, I think it was, and how to be healthy and everything. And then the next day she texted me and she was like, I'm not happy with the way that interview came out. Mm-hmm. And just don't publish it and don't use it. I was like, oh, wow, okay. And that was like 6 months into podcasting.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a blow to my self-esteem. But yeah, that was it, really.
Well, I guess it's some steps forward, a step back.
Yeah.
As long as it's always forward,
you,
right?
You could say that. And also, I mean, I did study journalism. I worked at a local newspaper here in Nicosia for 7 years. So, you know, interviewing people is... what I've always wanted to do. It was the reason I got into journalism in the first place. Mm-hmm. So what I'm doing now is exactly what I want to be doing. And I've, you know, interviewing is a skill and it needs to be tweaked and you need to practice and it takes experience. So I feel that finally I am able to deal with whatever I've got opposite me on whatever topic.
Okay, other than gorgeous guys giving your podcast interview.
Other than gorgeous guys coming on my podcast and distracting me completely.
I have a face for radio.
I know. It's really hard, Costa, to do interviews with.
But okay, so for those that are actually still with us and that haven't stopped listening, how about tell people what your podcast is called, where to find you?
So the podcast is called Mamma More. Mm-hmm. That was actually, I knew nothing about the podcast, but I knew that I wanted to call it Mamma More. It's just such a catchy saying that we use in Cyprus.
Yeah.
So it's called Mamma More and it's aimed towards women and mothers. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the audience as my topic category has grown and it's not just about women. Men are coming in as well, younger people as well, non-binary. But yeah, it always has a focus on the female representation, should I say, or experiences, their stories. There just wasn't anything in Cyprus like it. I mean, Magda was doing her kaleidoscope, which was focused on women. But for me, it was more about mums, mothers. I needed mums. I needed their stories and their experiences to come out. So that's how it started. And yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's put it this way. What is your bucket list for future guests you want to bring on?
Oh, wow.
So I haven't given you any pre-podcast recording.
No,
questions.
You haven't.
I wanted to throw you in the deep end.
Literally.
Because you gave me the courtesy of giving me a heads up what we're going to talk
about.
I'm
gasping right now. What am I going to say? Bucket list.
Well, I mean, I think you already mentioned one person about 5 minutes before the recording that you wanted to bring onto the show.
Oh, yeah. You're right. See, that just slipped my mind. But that did remind me of someone that I did interview, and I couldn't believe that I got to do that. And I'll say that as well. Yes, I would love to have Gedi Glirido on the podcast. For me, it's not so much specific names, more so experiences. So for me, it's really important to get more Turkish Cypriot women on the podcast, which I have done in the past. And obviously now with everything that's going on, tomorrow I'm interviewing a Palestinian girl. For me, it's important to give a space and a platform to the voices that you don't normally hear. And the person I was going to say that I did interview, it wasn't for the podcast, it was for a documentary and a project that I was working with a director, Andrulla Vasiliou. I got to go to her house and interview her in her living room. And for me, that was such a oh my god pinch me moment, because I remember my yaya used to love her so much in the 80s. I think we all have a lot of experience.
Well, she's a fascinating woman because she's just not your run-of-the-mill former first lady.
Exactly.
She has been a European commissioner. She's been involved in politics. She's been involved in the bicommunal technical committees. She's been on a million boards. I mean, and she's incredibly active. She's never stood back and vanished. She's always been a moderate. She's always been pro-culture, pro-peace, pro-humanity. I mean, she's a fascinating woman. And I think a lot of people underestimate her.
I agree.
And the fascinating thing about her, though, is that she was never shadowed by her husband, President Vasiliou. She was never, how do we put this? She was never made invisible as many women are. Now, I don't know if that's kudos to him or whether it's just her dynamic personality that shone through. But, I mean, here we are in 2023 and she's still very much around and active.
She's going. Yeah. She still has, you know, very strong opinions on, especially when it comes to women and mothers. So, yeah, and I did, and I got to interview the current First Lady as well.
Yes, I saw.
Which was, you know, wow. And I really liked her a lot, actually. You know, even though there were certain positions, you know, I don't know, on the church, maybe on feminism, maybe on these things, but where we possibly wouldn't agree. But meeting her, she was lovely. And I really, really liked her as well. And you know, once you get into these places and you start interviewing all these people, you get a lot of behind the scenes stuff as well that you wouldn't expect.
Well, I think a lot of people in Cyprus and around the world, but especially here in Cyprus, people don't realize that people, positions, politicians, events are not just what the media presents to you, and it's not just what social media presents to you. There's so much more to it, but we tend to take a simplistic approach to everything. Not to use anyone in particular as an example, but you'll have certain figures that people hate or love for XYZ reasons. But when you work with them or meet them or get to know them or get too involved with the circles around them, you start seeing the very complex intertwined networks and pulls and throws going on behind the scenes that we do not see, which can help us be more either empathetic towards the person or actually even dislike them even more, perhaps. I mean, there are things that we... Let's do a brushstroke example. Let's use the current conflict in Israel-Gaza as an example. We all see certain things presented to us by the media, presented to us by our friends and colleagues on social media. People that have researched the region forever will have a very different view of it, will have very different understandings of it. People living there will certainly have a very different perception of it, facing very different realities. But then you also have the people that are the decision makers over there, or how can I say, the perpetrators, if that's the right word, that are, you know, causing or reacting, being a victim of certain events. So they will all have very different views. But here we are in Cyprus and around the world with our very clear stated opinions mm-hmm. like we know.
From the comfort of our couch.
From the comfort of our couch. Now, okay, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have an opinion or we shouldn't be sympathetic or empathetic, but we also have to understand that it's never as clear as we understand. I mean, we can have a Wikipedia view of the world. So, I mean, your interview tomorrow with a Palestinian guest will be very interesting to hear. I found myself lately talking to Israeli friends, Jewish Israeli friends, secular Israeli friends. I found myself talking to ultra-Orthodox friends in other countries. I found myself talking to Arabs, Muslims, and some Palestinians, including a couple in Palestine. And it's been very interesting to see the overlapping opinions, the shared space of the reality of the perceptions. How two people in the same space witnessing the same thing can have a very different perception, justification, reaction to the same thing. And it's a eye-opener because, I mean, I've been researching the region for well over a decade. I've been to the region a few times. I've worked on it for many years. And now for me, it's been a real game changer. It's been a real... I'm going back to the drawing board and trying to realign my perceptions of everything.
With all the new realities, that's so interesting.
And I mean, I'm not going to say...
Was that a conscious decision?
It was.
Because,
it was.
I mean, before we put the microphones on, I was asking you, like, you were nowhere to be heard or seen the first couple of week or so, I think. And I was wondering, are you taking a step back to reassess?
Yes.
What is it?
Yes. No, it's exactly that, because this was something different. This was, to the Israelis, this was their 9/11. This was their September 11. I mean, I think it was Biden that said it was 11 times per capita bigger for Israel than it was for America. You know?
Yeah.
Okay, I get that. I mean, and it was graphic. It was live streamed on Facebook by the attackers. I will call them terrorists. I mean, the people that did the attack are terrorists. They're not your normal civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a horrific, horrific, horrific day for the Israeli people. And not certainly for the victims. And now, as we speak, for the hostages and the families of the hostages. I understand the Israelis that are demanding, every time somebody speaks, they're demanding condemnation of Hamas or an understanding of their suffering. All right, I get that. At the same time, we have the Palestinians now that for 2 weeks and counting have been under a heavy bombardment. They've been sieged. No water, electricity, fuel, food, medicine. I mean, it is a modern-day siege. I mean, the last modern-day siege that we would remember is the siege of Sarajevo. And we saw how that ended up.
Yeah.
And it's in the history books forever, this siege. And it worries me. It worries me. The effects on the Palestinian people, and especially the children. It worries me the relationship between the two entities after this conflict eventually is over. I mean, is it just going to be a rinse and repeat and we see you again in a few years' time for our next conflict? But coming back to your initial question, on the 7th of October, on the 7th of October, I knew immediately that this was not normal.
Okay.
And I knew that this would not elicit the normal response from Israel.
Okay.
I mean, I had my doubts as to how it happened, why it happened, how much knowledge Mossad and Israel had over it. I had my doubts about, you know, everything behind it.
I think in the initial reaction that a lot of us, well, you know, speaking as someone who is not a political analyst and doesn't know the backstory, first it was sort of like the horror of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing the body of a woman in the back of a truck.
Yeah.
And all these men spitting on her. And by the way, for me, this whole situation, while I can't obviously go into the political and historical side of it, for me, what it is the misinformation.
Oh, it's incredible.
And going back to that girl that I just talked about on the back of the truck, I've tried so hard to find out if that woman is alive or dead. Because in the beginning, they were saying that she was dead. Then there were accounts coming out saying that she's actually alive. Her mum sort of like confirmed that. Then there was nothing. Then we had the beheading of 40 babies. Then there were pictures. Then there was none. Then we had the bombing of the hospital. Then there was no signs that it was Israel that was responsible for this. And it's clearly a Hamas misfire. And as a person who's just watching all this and with a critical mind and a journalistic background, I am so bloody confused half the time. Yep. I cannot imagine what an average Joe is understanding from all this information that we are receiving from our mobile phones and from social media. Yep. You can't even trust the news.
No, you cannot trust anymore. The news. And we are all guilty of confirmation bias, whether we like it or not.
Yes,
we all have it.
Agreed. You are human, you have biases.
And it's not just our own unconscious bias, but it's our algorithms in our internet.
My God, that too. Yeah.
I mean, there are times that my Facebook will feed me a certain view and suddenly will feed me another view. Mm. If I consciously go and look for other information, I'm shocked by what I see.
Which is what I do as well.
And I always will try and find the flip side just to find out where the truth may be in between. it was like with that hospital bombing that you said. I mean, we heard condemnations and shock and horror, and the Arab world was up in arms. Then within 10 minutes, we had recorded phone calls between the two terrorists, basically admitting in a phone call that it was them. And then I sat there and I thought to myself, hang on, how on earth did we go from not predicting 5,000 rockets are going to be launched at Israel and 1,500 Hamas terrorists are going to storm the border and attack Israel? We couldn't predict that, but then within 5 minutes of an event, we have phone call recordings and videos, and I thought something is not right. Yes. However, to always play the neutral party, because I am a third party, I'm not Israeli, I'm not Palestinian, and I'm not Muslim, and I'm not a Jew. There are some realities on the ground that we're not going to deny. There was an attack. It was heinous. It was evil. It was sinister. Things went wrong. Things were very bad. It was horror. It was sheer horror. And for the hostages, it's still horror. We have Gazans, Palestinians in Gaza, and now Palestinians in the West Bank, which are coming under fire.
Yep.
They are suffering. There's photographs, there's video imaging, there's satellite imaging of entire neighborhoods wiped out. One party will say they're targeting this, the other party will say they're targeting that. We are seeing children being victimized. What I mean by victimized is, they're becoming victims to a conflict, which is not their conflict. They're children. It is never a children's conflict on either side of that border.
Kostamo, I have avoided any videos, any photos, just listening to children crying and screaming. For me is just so distressing and upsetting.
I'll show you two photos now for our listeners who aren't able to see this.
But are we going back to the hospital?
No, we're staying on the topic of children.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to show you three photos actually. Yeah. So this is the first one of these two young girls hugging, okay?
Sisters?
Now, we don't know. I do know, but you right now looking at this picture, you don't know who they are. You don't know their name, their religion, their nationality. You
nothing.
Know nothing. All you know that there are two girls hugging, looking pleasant and happy.
And they look about 6 and 3?
Yeah, maybe 5 and 3. Yep. Yeah. Okay. You will never know who they are, what they are, what their story is, okay? Now, there's another picture here. Now, you're going to probably guess where they're from just because of the image. But it's a picture of three girls who have just clearly been victims of some kind of bombing or something like that. They're alive. They seem to be okay.
Yeah.
Just traumatized and a bit dirty from dust and a couple of scratches. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, again, these two pictures, you don't know who they are really.
No.
Okay. And they using this second picture I've just showed you. Actually, no, let's start with the first one. They could be two Palestinian girls in nicer days taking a picture, or they could be two Israeli girls in nicer days taking a picture. The second picture of the three girls, they could be three girls in Gaza that have come under attack, or they could be three Israeli girls on the
7th of October.
You do not know.
Yes.
But as a mother, and myself as a father, I look at these images and I'm horrified because these are children.
Yeah.
They are not responsible for anything that goes on, whether it's the actual conflict, whether it's economic policy, whether it's farming policy.
Okay. They are so children. Why can't we all agree on that, Costa? Why can't the whole world agree that we should not be killing children? Children should not be dying.
No, and I mean, it's international. I mean,
it's very difficult saying, for me.
All week, I've been quoting this quote I saw online. I feel as helpless as international law.
Oh my God. I did a podcast the other day on war crimes. I had my bestie with me. She's a lawyer. Explain to me, are these not war crimes? Well, you know, this, that, and does it apply or does it not? If I break the law as Israel, as Hamas, as whoever I am I not subject to, do I not have to take that responsibility?
Correct.
Am I not to be penalized or?
Look, in battle, in war, bombs get dropped. Okay, if you are saying, I'm going to target this Hamas operative in this building, whatever, and you drop a bomb on it, and Israel claims that they give a warning, the knock on the roof phenomenon. Okay, they apparently send a small bomb which warns everybody, they evacuate, and then they drop the big one to destroy their compound. Somehow, children are missing these warnings. Okay, that's, we're not going to go into the details of that, we're not the experts. How can you order an evacuation of a certain area? People go to the so-called safe zones and are still being killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, coming back to my point about bombs get dropped in war. I get that. Bombs get dropped in war. I don't like it. I hate it, but it happens. In war, you're allowed to drop bombs, whether you're on the offense or defense, whatever the case is, wars, bombs drop. However, international law states clearly, clearly, you cannot have collective punishment.
Which you is cannot, what they did with the water and the food and the power.
You cannot siege. Okay. I mean, this is a human right and a breach of international law that's clear as day, that even the allies of Israel are saying you're breaching international law. Last night, the UN Secretary General Guterres came out and said as much as well.
And he
copped it from the Israel. Yeah. Now, I understand as well, and I'm going to be controversial when I say this, that Palestine has the right to defend itself, and so does Israel. Both have the right to defend themselves. The difference is that Israel is a recognized state and has international memberships everywhere. Palestine, at the UN, is only an observer state. So their right to defend never gets spoken about. We hear about the right to deoccupy or fight the occupation.
So my question there is Israel not the occupier?
According to international law, it is.
Okay,
yes.
So as an occupier, do you have the right to defend yourself?
Yes, occupied peoples have the right to fight for the occupation. I mean, it's how the UN came about. I mean, immediately after the UN was born, 78 years ago today, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, 78 years ago this week. Part of it was all about decolonization.
Mm.
It was all about, you know, ridding the British and the French and whatnot from Africa and Asia. Today's colonization, we're seeing it in the West Bank. Now, I have Israeli friends, some that are saying that they need to be there, some saying that it's their right to have it. I'm having others saying that, yes, we need to let go of the West Bank. We need to move away from the West Bank.
Mm.
Of course, the overarching concern is that if we remove ourselves from the West Bank, then they may just regroup, strengthen up and attack us. They're worried about the distance between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean is so small that they can be pushed to the sea in one foul swoop by the endless land of Arab world next to them. Again, I understand the Israeli fears. It's there. And you know, what everyone keeps harping on about the Israel's right to defend, sure. Do they have the right to be on the offense, though?
Yeah.
Do they have the right to literally flatten Gaza as we speak? Now, I don't know if people realize how small Gaza is.
Mm.
It's the size of free Famagusta. I mean,
and there's how many people living there? It's the most densely populated. I think I read or heard somewhere that for every square kilometer, there's about 4,000 to 6,000 people.
Yeah, it's. I don't know if it's the world's most densely, but it's one off definitely.
Yeah. So my question is, why are we okay with the bombing and killing of children?
Are we? I think we are okay.
Well, I don't see anyone telling Israel off.
I see people saying
I don't see us telling them off.
No, and all right, well, let's come to Cyprus. Cyprus is a fascinating case because the government was very quick to come out with the I Stand With Israel and to promote the Israeli right to defend, to show sympathies to the victims of the terrorist attack on them. I understand that, okay. Governments and states serve their interest.
Yeah.
Right now, their interest is to do good with Israel because it's a great business partner, it's a great source of security, it's a great friend to have in the region.
Mm-hmm.
The Cypriot government and the authorities feel that the Arabs have never really delivered on, you know, trade and peace and relationships and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, the people on the ground in Cyprus, I mean, this is not my personal opinion, I'm just saying what I see, the vast majority are pro-Palestine.
Do you see the protests the other day?
Yeah, I mean, the protests were big.
My God.
Yeah, I mean, and looking at the crowd, it wasn't Palestinians and Arabs. It was Cypriots.
No, there was a turn-up of around 2,000 to 3,000 people, apparently. Yeah.
And look, and it's understandable because, for example, the Greek Cypriots feel a sympathy to the Palestinians for land loss and occupations and whatnot. Granted, the Greek Cypriot reality today is very different to the Palestinian reality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Greek Cypriots live in comfort, we live in our houses, we live in freedom, we're a European Union member state. You know, we live next to an occupation, not under an occupation.
Yeah.
People in the West Bank, for example, live under occupation. I think I was listening to Queen Rania this morning talking with Christian Amanpour on CNN.
Mm.
She was saying that, you know, the West Bank is broken into 40 islands.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
I didn't know that.
If you the West Bank looks like cheddar cheese with all Swiss cheese. Sorry, with
all the holes. Yeah. Okay.
And basically, it can't operate as a territorially intact entity and efficiently run its affairs because it's just so broken apart. They can't move freely between the parts. So it is, and it's called the occupied territories, and the international community calls it that, okay?
Mm.
Israel has its reasons for it. Israel says we need to do it to keep our security because if we don't, they will team up against us and they will attack us or they will do whatever. And unfortunately for the Palestinians, they kind of got proven right when Hamas did what it did 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Because they said, okay, you know, we withdrew out of Gaza. I'm not going to go into the details of the blockade because we know the details there. It has been kind of sieged all this time anyway.
Mm.
But they did pull out of Gaza. It's technically not an occupied territory. It's a surrounded, blockaded territory, not an occupied territory.
Okay.
They elected Hamas. Hamas has turned into what it's turned into and did what it did 2 weeks ago.
Mm.
Unacceptable. We condemn it. I just want to put that out there before anyone says we don't. But Israel is now turning around and saying, well, you see what happens when we let them be free? But then the counter-argument to that is, what do you mean we let them be free? Look at the West Bank. It's the same people.
Yeah.
Just because it's split in over two areas with Israel in between doesn't make it two different countries.
Yeah.
It's one people, you know? And I think once this conflict eventually is over, I think there's going to be a lot of hard thinking in the Knesset, in Israel, in the circles, in the peace movements. A lot of them have fallen off the bandwagon at the moment. I think some of them will try and get back on.
Mm.
There's going to be a lot of going back to the drawing board. And clearly our model is not working.
No, whatever they're doing, it's not working. But I have a question. You're talking about Israel, who has this huge, really modern and up-to-date defense system.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say that? Yeah. Was there no other way for them to go into Gaza and take out Hamas?
Yes. I mean,
result in less casualties.
I'm sure there is, but I think what's happened is that they were driving on emotion and they still are.
Well, the thing is, and here for my questions, I mean, you know, you've got the whole ethnic cleansing, entire generations of Palestinians are being wiped out. I was listening this morning. Someone said like 9 families have been just like wiped off the map completely. And then you look at Netanyahu.
Mm.
And I heard yesterday on the news again, saying the news and you're thinking, this is a fact, but obviously you don't know. But it does make sense. His son is still in the States. He's not fighting. And I'll tell you why this bothers me, Costa. As a little lady who has kids and, you know, I do my school run and my supermarket run, I'm raising three boys.
Yeah.
For me, the biggest worry living in Cyprus is that my boys have to go and fight for this country, that they will be brainwashed to the point where sacrificing their life for the country is what they will probably end up wanting to do. So watching the news last night and realizing that that Netanyahu's son isn't even fighting, I was like, God, my God, I mean, I look at those soldiers, Costamo, and I can't, I know that not all of them are happy to be there.
No.
They're not all happy there, and they don't want to be there.
We've seen images, for example, of the IDF troops celebrating and partying and doing horrible things, but that doesn't reflect all of them, just like Hamas does not reflect all Palestinians.
Yes.
I mean, we have to stop assuming that the little snippets of things we see cover everything.
Yes.
If we see one Greek Cypriot burning a Turkish flag or, I don't know, writing on the wall, Cyprus is Greek.
It's not
representative. That doesn't represent
all
of us.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Just today, I mean, it's been a surreal morning for me. I got summoned to go to the army, that once a year that you get summoned for.
Okay?
That was the first time in 17 years that I've gone as a reservist to the army.
Okay.
Because for 17 years, for various reasons, namely because I was working for a foreign diplomatic mission, I was exempt from going because of conflict of interest. Now I don't. I'm a freelancer, so I was summoned. I went this morning, drove up to the gates of the army camp. Two young kids very casually asked me who I was. I showed them my little slip that shows me being summoned. Did they ask for my ID? No. Did they let me in with my car? Yes. Did they check my car? No. I mean, super relaxed. I mean, in this day and age, am I really Costa Constanti?
Yeah.
Am I really? I mean, my car had all today's podcast equipment in it.
Yeah.
Anyone, I was actually thinking that they might go through the car and scan and see all these electronic things and say,
think
no,
that
this
you're,
again.
Yeah.
But no, just drive through. And I've gone, where do I need to go? Don't know. Just go in and ask somebody. So because it was where I was stationed 17 years ago, I remembered where to go. So I just drove through, found the person I need to speak to, and within 5 minutes I was released. Half the soldiers were sitting there smoking. Half the in Greek it's called the monimi, the permanent staff.
Yeah.
Permanent staff were sitting there having their morning coffee. Yeah, everyone was relaxed. I'm like, this is the heightened sense of security that we have in Cyprus.
Yeah.
So then on
but
my
there's
way...
But there's policemen outside our kids' private schools.
Yes.
Yes.
There's very intense security going on in that.
But it's almost like it's a show. It's almost like
deterrence is always the biggest thing.
Anyway.
Now, only on this weekend, you know that, I mean, most people miss this, but a pipe bomb went off outside the Israeli embassy.
Yeah.
So many people are unaware of it. And this is quite serious.
Yes.
I mean, like, you could have had any one of our children walking past at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, luckily, there was no injuries. There were arrests. I mean, somehow the police were incredibly efficient and arrested people very quickly. Great. Okay. But moving back to today. So then after leaving the army camp, I've come to set up here. As I'm driving through the old town, the street was blocked by a bunch of kids from high school dressed in their best with Greek flags, and they were marching with their band. They're preparing for the 28th of October rally. Okay.
Yeah.
And I thought, these guys are better prepared than the military I just gone and visited half an hour earlier. You know?
Yeah.
And I thought, look at this reality. I'm going to come and talk to Eleni today, and we're bound to talk about Israel-Palestine. But here I am going to one of our army camps, seeing kids parading for an event that is a Greek public holiday. And I thought, what is this reality we're living in?
Yeah.
You know, like, we are so clueless to the realities of the world around us. You know?
Is it our mentality? Is it that, I don't know. But also, you know, going back to our own conflict, I mean, the majority of us, you know, we don't hate Turkish Cypriot people.
Can I be super controversial on my own program for
a
change?
Yeah, you can do whatever you want on your own program.
When I compare, now I'm speaking...
But before you answer that, sorry, I'm taking over here. No. I wanted to go back to Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this is personal for him?
Yes. Yep. And it's personal in the sense that he was unpopular prior to this. He was facing constant, I think it was like 40 days of protests and big protests against his rule.
Yeah. Every weekend, I heard, apparently. Or almost every day.
I think it was daily. Yeah. Like for 40 days nonstop. Yeah. I think before that it was weekends. But yeah. And then all of a sudden this gets delivered on a silver platter for him. Now, I'm not saying that he created it. I'm not saying that. But the timing is impeccable. And it's working in his favor. I mean, it saved his prime ministership.
But is it? Like, is Israelis now, Jews, are they...
They seem to be rallying around him.
Really?
I don't see the criticism. I mean, again, I'm not reading Hebrew.
Obviously.
Media yet.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not seeing in the mainstream questions being asked about this utter failure of security and intelligence. Mm. I'm not seeing questions being asked about the retaliation, the hostage negotiations. I'm not seeing anyone say ceasefire until the hostages come out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you know that where you're bombing, you're not killing your own
Thank
hostages?
You.
I mean,
Thank
this is a
you.
No-brainer.
Oh, is it? Really?
For me, it's a no-brainer.
Because I was thinking maybe there's something that you don't know about this, Eleni, but seriously, how do you know where you're bombing?
Well, because, you know, the Israeli intelligence service is so good that they know exactly where the Hamas and the hostages are, so they don't bomb there, apparently, according to some people I've heard. Now, you did not know this huge terrorist attack was coming, but now you know exactly where to bomb and not harm your hostages. Doesn't add up. Uh-huh. It's one or the other. Uh-huh. It can't be both.
Yes.
It can't be both.
Yes. Okay, sorry. So I wanted to know your feelings on the person, on the human that is Netanyahu.
Yeah, no, that's... I think it's very personal for him, and how he comes out of this is going to be historic, one way or another. Either it's going to be the end of him or the making of him. At this stage, it looks like it's the making of him.
Okay.
I just want to raise another point about the media and false media and whatever. Mm. The 85-year-old woman that was released yesterday with her friend, 70-something years old.
Yeah.
Did you watch the video? There was a video. So she's being handed over. So you have these two Hamas terrorists with their guns, their faces covered, their Arabic writing, the classic terrorist image that we've all come to.
Yeah.
Okay? And they're very gently handing her across to the Red Crescent or Red Cross, whoever they were. They're talking to her in English, saying, "You're safe now. Come back. Come, you know, off we go." And the Hamas terrorists are, you know, giving her candy, whatever, giving her. Okay, I can agree that that's propaganda, sure. We know we're being videoed. Let's look nice. But the woman steps towards her saviors, and as she's being freed, she stops and turns around and handshakes one of the two terrorists and says, "Shalom, shalom," like peace, peace. And it...
Oh, I've got goosebumps.
It startled me because I thought, what the heck? Like, you have just been held hostage for 2 weeks. I'm assuming it wasn't a pleasant experience being kidnapped, being taken across a border, being taken underground, 2 weeks of not knowing what the heck is going on, and her husband is still hostage in Gaza. With what power did this woman turn around and say, "Shalom, shalom," and handshake the guy holding a gun? You know,
what did you think of that? What did you make of it?
Because
I'm thinking it may also be Stockholm Syndrome.
I thought it may be Stockholm Syndrome, and that makes a lot of sense. I understand Stockholm Syndrome. She may have also felt an overwhelming sense of relief, and that brought out the pleasantry. Whatever the case is, however, it was I don't want to use the word beautiful moment, but it was an odd moment that would be recorded for the end of time, okay? Mm. The media initially was showing this and this odd moment, and they mentioned how she was treated very well. They even listed what she was eating. They said she was eating cucumbers and hard cheese, and she was eating the same thing as her captors. Okay. Then the media, the next day, and I've taken lots of screenshots because it's a PhD in itself. It starts with "they treated me well" headlines. "They fed me cucumber and hard cheese" headlines. To now, it was a living hell. I was living in a spider web of tunnels. All this negative, harsh rhetoric now. And it's like, the video doesn't lie. It's not an AI video. It's a video that's released. It's not denied by anyone. She said that she was treated well. Granted, when she was kidnapped, that was horrific. People were being shot and killed around her.
Yeah.
I get that. But once she was in the tunnels, she was treated well. I'm not saying that it makes it okay that she was a hostage. God, no.
But see, I had no idea about these headlines. Yesterday, I avoided the news as much as possible. And I watched the evening news on Cyprus telly. You're laughing. And yeah, I keep switching between the major channels. I did not see any of what you just mentioned.
So I'll just show you now.
I saw them. I saw the interviews that they did with captive Hamas members saying what Hamas had promised them if they kidnap or kill so many people or whatever. Yep. But what you just said...
Yep.
About the video, the handshake, the what they were feeding, I did not see.
So for those that can't see this, I'm now just showing Eleni just a still from the video of the captive turning around and handshaking the terrorist. So you see him, he's decked out, your classic terrorist cartoon style image. You know, he's got his bandana and he's got his gun and she's leaning back and thank him. She's leaning back.
But you can see her face that's smiling as well.
I mean, and I'm not saying, I'm not justifying the hostage taking. All I'm, my focus of this discussion now is just how the media changes.
Yes,
things.
Yes.
So even this woman's daughter told the BBC, and I quote, that the gesture was in keeping with her mum's character. Quote, it's so her, unquote. So even the daughter has come out and quote to the BBC, that's so my mum. My mum will say thanks to anyone. My
it's like what
nice
she would do
everyone.
If someone just delivered a package at her house.
Exactly. But then the same media agency, for those that caught it when I dropped it, says, then the next article is, I've gone through hell. We were scared. We'd become sick. So it focused on all her negative. It was so painful I couldn't breathe. Granted, she probably did say all this because, yes, she was kidnapped. She was lugged along. I mean, it would have been hell. I mean, anyone getting kidnapped for any reason, it's hell. But you cannot report and skew one way or another, whether it's positive or negative, by the way, because some media in some societies is showing it as, look how well they're being treated, and in other societies showing it as, look how bad they're being treated. It's somewhere in between. I personally believe they were treated horrifically bad on kidnapping and probably being treated relatively good now if they're all alive still.
According to terrorist guidelines and rules, yeah.
According to terrorist guidelines and
but
rules.
But that's thing. For me, that is one of the biggest issues that is being raised in this whole situation, this whole conflict, leaving aside as much as you can the fact that, you know, bloody kids are dying and losing their mothers and mums are losing their kids, parents are losing their kids. You know, there's no word for that.
No.
There is no word for a parent losing their child.
I just want to interrupt you because something's been bugging me.
Yeah.
When Serbia was attacking Kosovo, do you remember how the international community received Albanian children refugees? I was in Australia at the time.
Mm.
Children of the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo were being shipped out to different countries around the world for protection.
Okay.
In World War, British children were being sent out to the farms to protect them from the London bombing, the Blitz.
Yeah.
All these different countries. In Sarajevo, during the siege, any child that could get out was being shipped out and protected in other countries.
Mm.
Why is Rafah border not being open? First of all, to get the foreigners out. Mm. Second, to get out some of the serious injured kids. Let's just keep it to the kids.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, and I'm sorry, but Egypt has a hand to play in this as well.
Yes.
Now, I understand Egypt is concerned about having 2.5 million Gazan refugees in the Sinai Peninsula, which is already a mixed salad. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I get it, but they can get out.
What about
out.
Humanitarian aid? Can't they do that?
Humanitarian aid needs to go in. That's what there's no doubt about that. I mean, the UN, as you know, always gives very measured announcements, very measured comments, but they are being very firm about this.
Yeah, they said.
Yeah,
we're done. Everything's closing down. It's just everything is halted to a grind.
And by the time everyone's listening to this podcast in the next 24 to 48 hours, we'll know what's happened tonight, whether the hospitals have shut down or not, because they've got a few hours left of fuel.
Oh my God.
Think about the siege of Famagusta or the siege of Nicosia 500 years ago. If you remember your history in any way, when the Ottomans surrounded Famagusta, the Venetians would paint a cow. This is the story, and I don't know if it's true, but this is the story.
Okay.
They would paint a cow different colored spots every day and parade it on the wall to show the Ottomans that we've got a bunch of cows in here, we're fine. You know, we can outlast this siege, okay? So the Ottomans sat there and waited it out for a while. The Venetians kept parading this one cow with different colors every day on the walls. This is the medieval period. It's not 2023.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We don't need to paint cows to show the Israelis that the Gazans have enough food. They mm-hmm. don't.
Yeah.
The UN is in Gaza mm-hmm. reporting live. Now, if you don't trust the UN, you trust no one. Because the UN is not a state.
Yeah.
Within the UN, you have Israeli people in the UN. You have Turks in the UN. You have Cypriots, Greeks in the UN. The UN is all of us.
Yes.
So it's somewhat neutral. So it's appalling.
Can I trust the UN then? Can I trust what comes out of the UN is fact, whatever that means anymore?
I think you've always got to remember that what comes out of the UN is a report on the day written by a certain person or group of people. It
okay.
can change. It's fluid. It's not firm. The UN needs drastic reform. That's a topic of another podcast,
really?
I think. It
wow.
needs drastic reform. I mean, who are the big five? I mean, they're the victors of World War II. The world has changed since then.
Mm-hmm.
Russia, China, and the US are not friends anymore.
Yes.
You know, so the world has changed. The UN needs to update, and it hasn't, and it's going to be next to impossible to do it. This is why I think a lot of people are turning towards the African Union, the European Union, different groups of mediators or observers that may be a little bit less messy.
Okay.
But coming back to whether what the UN says, if it's true or not, I think it's probably the closest to the truth that you'll ever get. And it can definitely be questioned.
Mm.
And you'll definitely hear different opinions. And this is the reason why you always get such measured announcements, because there's so many people giving an opinion. They've got to give one that meets everyone.
Yeah.
But in this case, for the first time in a long time, we're seeing a very, very firm statement against the siege.
Yeah. The other question I was going to ask, news sources, which do you trust? Where do you go to?
All of them and none of them.
Really?
You trust no one and you read all of them.
You know, I was watching Euro News the other day and I was like, okay, I see no emotions in this. I see no bias in this. I just see factual reporting. And I go back to that misinformation and the fact that where is our factual reporting? Who is checking?
You won't, and it's impossible, and there's no point finding it, to be honest with you. The only way you can do it is to check all sources.
You have to do it yourself.
You have to. If you want to be decent about it and have... Look, you can align yourself to a certain media source if you want and just go with it. That's fine. But if you actually want to know the truth, if you actually care, or if you actually want to make a statement or get involved, then you need to have a wide-ranging view. And I'm talking about, I'll give you an example. After Russia attacked the Ukraine, the European Union banned Russia Today on LTV. How on earth is that a democratic move? It's... granted, according to the European Union, it's a propaganda station, blah, blah, blah. But they took away my right to hear what Russia is saying about the war. So if I want to hear the Russian perspective, I've got to go to Russian sources or speak to Russian people. But Russia Today was an easy-to-digest deliverable.
Okay?
I'm not saying that Russia Today is great either, don't get me wrong.
Mm.
But it's like in Russia, I don't know if this is the case, but I'm just saying now, they may have blocked CNN. Is that fair? Does the Russian, don't the Americans want the Russian people to see CNN and see another side of the story? So what I do now, for example, I'm reading the Middle East and I'm looking at BBC, I'm looking at Haaretz, I'm looking at the Times of Israel, I'm looking at English language, Arab press. I'm talking primarily to friends in Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Egypt, Jordan, you know, like I'm talking to different people all over the place, because it's the only way you will ever get a somewhat clearer picture of what's happening.
I think, you know, when you say you speak to all these people, I think that is also a factor that we have to all consider. And it's not just in this context of the war. You know, it goes to women's rights. It goes to LGBTQ rights.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to minority rights. When you actually take the time to meet and speak with people who you do not normally interact with,
yep.
it gives you, it you get the humanity of that person.
Of course.
You get the humanity of that person and you understand that person better. And, you know, for me with Turkish Cypriots, I grew up in England until the age of 10. And then I came to Cyprus and I was fed that propaganda that over there, you know, monsters are living and they will come for you at night and they will rape and torture and kill you. And then reaching a point where my kids are going to school with Turkish Cypriot kids, I'm meeting Turkish Cypriot mums. They are my friends now and I love them to bits. Mm-hmm. I had to go out and make those connections to let that propaganda and that veil of whatever it was where I was learning in school drop and finally realize that actually over there, no, it's not monsters and devils and demons that are living.
Yeah.
It's people like me, mums like me.
With their stories.
With their stories, with their experiences. And how similar are we? And, you know, we did a podcast with Pembe Menteş and I forgot her name now. I shared Talat. We were talking and we were saying the same things. She was saying the first time I met a Greek Cypriots, I was like, my God, they're like us. They're people like us. And, you know, and we were saying the same thing.
Yeah.
So apart from doing that, Costa, that you just said, speaking to all these people, getting all these experience, understanding their humanity, the different layers of trauma, of experiences that they have, is so bloody important.
It's totally important. It also helps you form an understanding, an empathetic understanding to their demands and their fears.
Yeah.
For example, a Turkish Cypriot would say that I'm worried about the reunification of the island because what would be my security? I didn't have great security before 74. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about that reoccurring. Yeah. So the same with an Israeli would say the same thing. I'm worried that if the state of Palestine is legitimized and they have a very clear border and they develop as a state, the Israelis talk about the double minority the same way we talk about a double minority, where Greek Cypriots are the Turkish Cypriots are a minority in Cyprus, but they're a majority when it comes to the Greek-Turkish Cypriot triangle. The Israelis, it's a similar thing. They're the majority in the Levant, let's use that word, but they're a minority in the Middle East by far.
Mm-hmm.
So the Palestinians are saying, oh, but you're a majority and you're slaughtering us. But then the Israelis are saying, oh, but we're a minority and can be slaughtered at any moment by our neighbors.
Mm.
And the Yom Kippur War kind of proved their fears were true because they were attacked on multiple fronts. And it remains to be seen what's going to happen in the next few weeks, whether Hezbollah is going to jump in, whether Iran is going to send other backers in. It remains to be seen. And there's a reason why the international community is sending over warships to the Eastern Mediterranean and Cyprus being the great refueling spot next door. You know, like our neighborhood is becoming a little bit crowded at the moment.
It is, isn't it?
And meanwhile, us Cypriots are very concerned about what this is going to do to the Cyprus problem because that is our priority.
Of course.
And not the living and dying people next door.
Yes, of course.
You know,
you get to the point where what is wrong with us? Can we just go back to the basics?
I mean, we are living in a place where, I'm going to talk for the Greek Cypriots now, we are living in comfort, okay? We are living in European comfort. Yeah, we have a lot of hysterically pathetic forms of governance at times and, you know, a mismatched system and hotpotch system, you know. But at the end of the day, we are living a luxurious European life. We're basically, I don't know, the worst of Europe and the best of the Middle East. I don't mean, how would you put us? But
oh, I like that.
Yeah. I mean, we can, for example, reunify the island because there's not that much ground to cover to normalize the situation.
Mm.
Israel and Palestine, there is a chasm between them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you look over to the Middle East, our problem is minuscule compared. Yeah. It's so solvable if we want to. And I mean this for all Cypriots, Turks and Greeks.
Mm.
When I say Turks, I mean Turkey and Greece.
Yeah.
We can solve it overnight if we wanted to. It would be, and I put my fingers in the air, a painful compromise, but we can solve it and continue our luxurious life. Israel, Palestine, can it be solved?
It's too many layers there.
It's far too many layers, and it will come at a very painful compromise, and it will need the international community to hold whatever Frankenstein gets put together.
Can I ask you something?
No.
And this can be our last question if you want. I've been going back and forth a lot, and this is what I did when I was preparing for my podcast with my Turkish Cypriot girlfriend. What if women were at the table?
Things would be very different.
Do you think that?
Totally different. And when we say women at the table, we've got to be very clear that we don't just mean one woman or one type of woman. It has to be a selection of women.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, we talk about women being equal, okay, to men.
Yeah.
There's no denying that. Unfortunately, people deny it, but there is no denying. Women are equal to men. In fact, you're 51% of the population, so you're technically a majority. You are a majority. You need to have at the table women that are mothers, single, divorced, far right wingers, far left wingers, lesbian, bisexual. You got to have every
yes.
kind of woman at the table.
Yeah.
Just like by default for so long we've had every type of man at the table.
Thank you.
Because everyone talks about it. Oh, let's just put a symbolic woman on the table.
No.
No.
No,
it can't be just a woman. It can't be Golda Meir that Israel had for a while. I mean, like, you know, this is one woman.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have Margaret Thatcher because that was one woman.
Yeah.
It needs to be everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm going to sound really, really super controversial now. I don't believe in quotas in the sense of when we elect a party or whatever, there has to be an X number of women elected. What I do believe, there should be quotas in the candidacies. Because by having them in the candidacies increases the chances and the likelihood that they might get through. Now, if they're not elected, that says something about the electorate, and that's what needs to be worked on as well at the same time. I'm not denying that. But you cannot alienate the men by saying, you know what, we're going to have a board of 10 people and 4 of them have to be women. It's like, well, they're going to come back with the answer. What if they don't want to be on the board? Or what if they're not qualified? There can be some truth to that.
Yeah.
But of the 50 candidates for those 10 spots, half of them should be women.
Mm.
Until we don't need to have that anymore, if that day ever comes.
I just, you know, I go back and forth with this a lot. And I think, you know, the majority of women are mothers. I don't know if that's actually right. But I can't imagine a board of women deciding to just bomb relentlessly and kill thousands of kids. You know, and you can say, does it have anything to do with gender? I don't know if it has any. I mean, it certainly doesn't have anything to do with, you know, reproductive organs. But I just keep going back to the fact that if, you know, Netanyahu was a woman, if Hamas was made of women, would we be seeing this right now?
Do you know what's interesting? You just made me think something that I haven't thought for a long time. If indeed men and women are equal, do we need to have women forced onto leadership? I mean, not forced, put into leadership if they are equal. You're saying...
But that they're not equal in their realities, are they?
Thank you. Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, my reality as a woman, as a mother, is very vastly different from yours, even though you are a father.
Yeah. No. And actually, this comes to my next point. I wanted to finish by saying that I want to invite you back where we're not going to talk politics.
Ooh.
We're going to talk about you as a mother of 3 boys and me as a father of 3 girls.
Yes!
And that's all we're going to talk about.
Yes.
It's going to be a much lighter podcast where
Let's
we're going to be spending more time laughing and having a good time as opposed to
depressing
our audience.
Oh, but we have to come prepared, though.
No, we're going to come. This is going to be different. Today, I want it to be candid.
But this is what I see as a mother of boys, and you have to say this is what I see.
No. I'm going to send you.
I've actually
got the list of questions ready. So
I was actually
going to give it to you today, but I've actually not brought it with me.
All right.
But that's my plan for the next time. But just to end today's podcast on a much lighter note, because people that are actually still listening probably not feeling so great right now.
Yeah.
So let's just, you always ask me on your podcast, what am I watching on Netflix or what am I reading or whatever. Yeah. For once, I have an answer for you.
Well, do you?
I do. I'll make it
a good one.
I mean, it's spelled L-U-P-I-N on Netflix.
Lupin. Lupin.
Yeah. I'm calling it Lupin.
Lupin. Lupin. It's Lupin.
Lupin.
Is it good? I haven't watched it.
Fantastic.
Really?
It is the French version of Casa de Papel, as in not the same story, as in the same quality of scripting and storyline.
Okay.
It's brilliant.
All right.
Yes. And it was recommended to me by a friend, and I'll actually shout out to Paul Henri Anni and his wife Anastasia, who are leaving Cyprus after 10 years, who Paul Henri was the head of the Cyprus Missing Persons the Committee of Missing Persons Cyprus. After 10 years, he's leaving Cyprus, and I want to give a shout out to his amazing dedication and work after all these years. I wish him all the best in his, I don't want to use the word retirement because he's got so much ahead of him, from scuba diving to living in the Alps above Geneva. I mean, he's got a great...
Not jealous at all.
Not jealous at all. And Anastasia is going, and she's going to be studying a bit more nutrition and doing some more studies. So, now, I do not remember why I even brought them up.
They recommended
They're the ones that recommended Lupin to me. So I want to thank them for that. They were very right. I'm enjoying it.
Okay.
Yes. And if you want to look at a one-sided view of the conflict, it's worth watching Born in Gaza and also Born in Syria.
Okay.
It's also on Netflix. I am going to, in the next few days, watch... it's the Shimon Peres documentary. I've just forgotten what it's called. But if you type in Shimon Peres...
And that's on Netflix?
On Netflix, yeah. Okay. So it's good to get some different views. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are obviously very one-sided, but I mean...
Yeah.
You know, start on one side and go see the other.
Yeah.
But what are you watching?
Oh, okay. So I haven't been watching much, to be honest, lately. It's just been busy. And then all of a sudden it's 9 o'clock. I've just watched the news, and I'm an old lady, so I go to bed at 9:30.
Oh, no way.
Like 10 o'clock, if it's 10 o'clock and my eyes aren't closed, I'm freaking out. I watched a 90s movie the other day. This sounds so weird, but I watched the original Scream.
Oh, wow.
On the Friday, and talk about a distraction, man. Talk about, like, literally escapism.
Could you watch it and be scared, or did you find it funny this time around?
Oh, no, for me it was just nostalgia. Okay, it wasn't about being scared. Obviously, you know. And it's made in the 90s, so, you know, visually it's
am I right to say Neve Campbell's in it, right?
Neve Campbell's in it.
See what I remember?
Courtney Cox is in it. David Arquette is in
it. Yeah, that doesn't matter. Neve Campbell was in it.
Right. Rose McGowan is in it.
What is she name dropping?
Oh, no. Do you know why? Because Rose McGowan has been very vocal lately about the Me Too movement. And I have some disagreements with her, but whatever. Anyway, so 90s movies... make me feel good.
Okay.
They bring out a certain joy.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, if it's nostalgia.
Yeah,
or what it is. But yeah, and I watched that movie it was made in 1996 there.
Wow.
I was 15 at the time.
I wasn't 16. Even born.
Yeah, you weren't. Of course you weren't. Oh, you have to watch it, Costa. Because Netflix made this big announcement that Scream was coming, and I was ready to watch it with my almost 13-year-old, and I was like, it's badly made, but we're going to watch it together. And then it's the new version, the 2021 or 20, and I'm like, what is this shit? I want the original. So I went and found the original, and I watched that on Friday.
I'm going to have to watch that again because I can only see it in a comical way now because of all the spoofs of the Screams.
Okay, exactly, scary movies. And I was going to say I've also been, I've caught up with my Sex and the City new episodes and Just Like That. So I'm with the girls in their 50s in New York.
Well, you know what?
Escapism, Gosta. I need it.
I'm planning to go back and watch the Godfathers movies because I was on a working holiday now for a month and a bit in North America, the US and Canada. And I went to the Academy Museum in Los Angeles, and they had the Godfather set and his desk and Marlon Brando's costume and the actors' suits and everything. And I was just...
I hate you.
I got so nostalgic.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was amazing. I mean, it's totally... It's an amazing museum to visit.
Yeah.
So it made me want to go and watch the...
The Godfather. Yeah.
But before I forget, the other movie... The other documentary goes for an hour that's worth watching. It's called Ordinary Men, The Forgotten Holocaust. And what it is it questions, I'll read the description. The documentary examines how and why thousands of ordinary Germans carried out mass atrocities as members of Nazi police squads during the Holocaust.
Mm.
And I've always had this question, how did so many people
get them to do that?
And it's a really good documentary, okay. Very well made.
Oh, now that you've mentioned.
And sorry, I just found the title of the Shimon Peres. It's called Never Stop Dreaming, The Life and Legacy of Shimon Peres.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. So that and Ordinary Men. Okay. Yeah. And also on Netflix, I think it was a few months ago, I watched Hitler's Inner Circle of Evil.
Yes, yes. I saw that.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, here we are in 2023 and we're still talking about World War. Isn't it incredible?
It is incredible, but it's also incredible how they did all that propaganda shit without social media.
Yeah. Oh, it's the OG of propaganda.
Oh, my God.
Incredibly efficient. It's funny because, and I'm going to be controversial when I say this, the Nazis were the first propaganda experts and successful at it.
It's true.
The byproduct or spin-off, should I say, of World War II was the post-Holocaust Hollywoodization of the suffering of the Jewish people, where here we are 100 years later and we are still as empathetic to the victims of the Holocaust as we were back then. Not saying we shouldn't be, but we don't have the same for the victims of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, of, you know, all the different wars that have happened around the world. But for some reason, now, is it because there are that many Jewish directors in Hollywood? I don't know. But it's just funny how...
Well, you're pulling a Kanye there, aren't you?
Yeah. No, but it's just interesting how the propaganda masters became... And their victims became... I'm going to use the word propaganda masters as well for the lack of a better word right now. But it makes me wonder, is that because the Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, a lot of them came from Germany and had the same education as their German Nazi former colleagues? Yeah. You know, and I'm looking for a book or a piece, if anyone can write it to me, because there's got to be something on that. There has to be.
It is an interesting take, and especially, comparing it to what we're seeing and what's happening now.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. Well, thank you so much. And as always, we've gone over an hour because you and I both like the gas bag.
We love it.
Next time we need to have a third party here with a little bell and warn us. But thank you, Eleni Moore. I really appreciate it. Make sure you guys check out Eleni's podcast, Mama Moore. It's available on all the good channels. There'll be a link in this post as well. And look forward to seeing you again very soon.
I'm going to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ciao.
Bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.